Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. As you've probably heard, our genes are the ultimate book of instructions for all that happens in our body. However, when and where genes turn on to print their instructions are influenced by various things, including our constantly changing environment. Breast cancer, it can be said, results from mistakes in genes and or their instructions, and these mistakes are often caused by environmental influences. The program today is going to discuss known and suspected environmental risks for breast cancer and some possible preventative suggestions. Our guest by telephone in California today is Dr. Ted Shettler. Dr. Shettler is a science director for the Science and Environmental Health Network. He received his MD at Case Western Reserve University and an MPH from Harvard School of Public Health. You can reach us with any questions or comments you have in a couple of ways. Our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org, and our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Dr. Shettler, welcome once again to Line One, your health connection.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for asking me to join you.
Well, it's easy to join you. You're going to be coming up here and giving some presentations both to some of the medical professionals as well as the general public, my understanding is.
I am. I'm coming later this week, and we'll be in your area for a little over a week.
I'll go ahead and just give people a little bit of a heads up on that. You'll be at an open lecture Monday, April 25th. There's a reception at 6:30 p.m., the lecture from 7 to 8, here at the Alaska Public Media TV studios on University Drive. That's this coming Monday, a week from today, April 25th at 6:30 p.m. And then you'll also be at the Providence Grand Rounds for Health Professionals this Friday, April 22nd. Also, my understanding is you're going to make some tour up to Fairbanks and Nome as well.
That's right, yes.
And for people who would like more information, you can call this phone number, 907-222-7714, 222-7714, if you want more information on Dr. Shettler's agenda when he'll be in Alaska talking about the ecology of breast cancer. So let's ask that question. What do you mean by the ecology of breast cancer?
Well, you know, breast cancer is the most common cancer in women. And yet, if you step back and look what we know about risk factors for breast cancer, no one or two really stand out nearly as strongly as the impact of, say, cigarette smoking on lung cancer risk. And rather, what we actually see is a collection of risk factors that interact, creating conditions that make breast cancer more or less likely in populations of people. And I want to point out that I am talking about it in this sense in populations of people because there are individual risk factors that may pertain to an individual person that would increase her risk, for example, that may not be widely shared in the entire population. But nonetheless, it's an important question. But I also want to point out that some of these risk factors are clearly the result of individual behavioral choices, but others are community-level, ecosystem-level, or societal-level risk factors that are beyond the control of an individual. And it seemed to me that this is really like the analysis of an ecosystem. And that's why I chose this terminology. For example, if we look at the health of a forest or a mountain or a marine system, it's not dependent on one or two factors, but rather there are interactions among climate, weather, rainfall, pollution from various sources, soil quality, and the plant and animal communities that collectively create conditions of health or disease. And these ecosystems, as we all well know, can either be vulnerable or resilient. And if it's a vulnerable ecosystem that's operating close to a threshold of harm, when that threshold gets crossed, you have very different operating conditions that can cause a lot of adverse effects throughout the system. Whereas in a resilient ecosystem, it may and often does absorb a stressor that would tip a vulnerable ecosystem over the edge. A resilient ecosystem can handle that, can absorb that stressor. And I thought that this kind of thinking, as it relates to chronic diseases in humans, was useful, and particularly with regard to something like breast cancer, where we really do have this collection of risk factors that create conditions that either result in increased or decreased risk. I actually think that there's plenty of evidence that beginning with in utero development, we actually can influence the conditions in individuals and people that increase or decrease the likelihood of breast cancer, literally modifying the susceptibility to this disease through a variety of mechanisms. And I think there's a lot of value to doing this. I mean, I don't see this as just being an academic exercise, but it helps us really understand the systemic nature of the problem, that we're going to have to find broad, diversified efforts that collectively will help influence the trajectory of this disease and the patterns of this disease. And it helps us to identify strategic ways to intervene to help improve system conditions to make breast cancer less likely. So that's sort of the origin of the terminology.
Right. And the first thing I would say, just to make sure listeners heard that really well, that in some one cancer in particular that you mentioned, lung cancer, where there's such a high correlation to a large percentage of lung cancers being associated with smoking, that would be that individual behavior you're talking about, whereas all of us have this community-wide exposure to perhaps increase multiple different kinds of cancers or even illnesses outside of the cancer diagnosis that are related to what's happening from conception on. Is that fair to say?
Conception on and at multiple levels. Individual behavior, community-level variables, societal level, ecosystem level, absolutely. And the interactions among them are really primary and not secondary, of primary concern. That's ecological thinking rather than taking this system apart into individual pieces and trying to figure out precisely to what extent one variable is contributing to the outcome.
Before we focus on breast cancer, I want to focus on this idea of the ecology of illness, that if I broaden your framework just a little bit, because it's also smacks of the early life origins of disease hypothesis, which implies that maybe things that are happening post-conception in utero shortly in the first several years of life can affect lifelong outcomes in heart disease, risks of obesity, depression, and so forth. There's been a lot written about that, particularly, I'm aware of that particularly because as a pediatrician, there's a concept that the first 1,000 days of life are very critical for long-term outcomes of individuals.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, and I think we're seeing more and more evidence of this across a whole range of diseases, including diseases of aging, where, for example, there are studies showing that the risk of cognitive decline and dementia much later in life can have its origins early in life as well. So I think this is one of the major sort of breakthrough understandings of the last 15 or 20 years that, as you point out, makes it more and more clear to us that we really should be paying attention to the first 1,000 days of life.
Okay, thanks. All right. Let me remind you, listeners, one more time, real quickly, that you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Ted Shettler. He's really an expert on breast cancer and environmental influences. He's let us know already about this bigger spectrum of a way of looking at cancers, and we've mentioned that even other illnesses, that it's the total environmental influences from conception on that really begin to interplay both positively and negative in health outcomes. If you've got questions today, particularly about breast cancer and its ecology, let me tell you how to get in touch with us over the next 50 minutes or so. Our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433. Our email address is line1, spell that out, in LINEONE, line1@alaskapublic.org, and a toll-free number if you'd like, 1-888-353-8433. 5752. Well, first off, as we get back to breast cancer, let's be sure everybody understands breast cancer is not the same as breast cancer is not the same as breast cancer. There's different kinds of breast cancer. What are you talking about today? What do we want people to think about when we use the term breast cancer today?
Well, I will talk about breast cancer generally, but you're absolutely right. We need to keep in mind that everything that I might mention may not pertain to all kinds of breast cancer. Really, breast cancer is a whole collection of diseases, and there are different classification schemes. One of the most common that many people will be familiar with is the hormone receptor status of the cancer. Is it positive or negative for the estrogen receptor, for the progesterone receptor, for the HER2 receptor? And people will commonly talk about that as being receptor positive or receptor negative. And the reason this is important is because it has tremendous treatment implications as well as prognosis implications. Triple negative breast cancers, where the cells do not feature hormone receptors, are notoriously more difficult to treat and tend to be more aggressive, whereas hormone receptor positive breast cancers, that particularly estrogen receptor positive, that shows up later in life, is much less aggressive, and treatment is quite successful in most cases, and it's just a different behaving tumor. There are other classification schemes which get into the various cell types that you see when you look at a tumor underneath a microscope, and these have implications both for understanding the origins and also the treatment implications. So there are a number of different classification schemes, but I guess the bottom line is that it's a collection of cancers, some of which are much more aggressive than others, and with real treatment and outcome implications.
All right. I want to work again slowly towards this idea of environmental influences on cancers. But perhaps to do that, if you wouldn't mind, take us through the development. A normal cell, as it changes, we begin to get some breast cancer. How many mutations, how many changes, how many insults does it take to really get to that point where we make a diagnosis? I hope that's a fair question to ask you, but I think it'd be interesting for the listeners.
Yeah, it's a fair question to ask. I'll point out that I'm not a cancer biologist, but it's an area that I am familiar with. Before getting into the cell type, I would just comment that one of the interesting things, of course, about the breast that distinguishes it from other organs in our body is that, it begins to form during fetal development. And then there's after birth, there's sort of a quiet period in the run-up to puberty. But then during puberty, there, of course, is fairly rapid development of breast tissue, and the cells begin to mature and differentiate in particular ways, and until through adolescence and so on. But until the first pregnancy, if a woman is going to have children, until the first pregnancy, the breast tissue remains in a somewhat immature state. With rapidly dividing cells, and then along with pregnancy and the hormonal changes, there's a rapid further development of the breast to be able to then begin to produce milk. And so during the time between puberty and a first pregnancy is a time of real vulnerability because there's rapid cell division, an opportunity for DNA replication to make mistakes, where mutations happen, whether it's from simply a random mutation or from an environmental influence. And with rapid cell division going on, there's less time for DNA repair. So this is sort of the time of vulnerability. But as you've indicated in your question, at some point DNA mistakes, mutations begin to occur. And the notion of hallmarks of cancer has gained a lot of standing. In recent years, a couple of cancer biologists by the name of Hanahan and Weinberg laid this out about 10 years ago, and they continue to refine it. But the idea is that there are certain things that need to happen in order for a cancer that's been initiated to go ahead and progress and develop into a clinical tumor that gets diagnosed. cells need to sustain their proliferation and signaling. And if they have a mutation that's problematic, they will continue to make more of those. They need to evade growth suppressors. They need to resist cell death, because there's a natural process called apoptosis, which is programmed cell death. And if a tumor is overcome with apoptosis, that's the end of it before it's ever diagnosed. So it needs to figure out how to resist cell death. Then it needs to, as it grows, induce blood vessel supply so that it gets nutrients. And it needs to become immortal in the sense that it will no longer enter into a cell fate which leads it to quiescence, but rather it continues to replicate, and then ultimately invasion and metastasis. And in more recent work along these lines, Hanahan and Weinberg have talked about the importance of the surrounding tumor environment, that there's tumor-promoting inflammation and avoiding immune destruction. So these are sort of neighborhood features that support the growth of a tumor as it's developing. And I think if we step back from this, this actually fits in well with the notion of an ecosystem, the ecology of the tumor. You know, back in the 1960s, Charles Huggins, who received the Nobel Prize for work on hormonal influences on breast cancer, said in his Nobel acceptance speech that the soil surrounding the tumor was essential for promoting its growth and development. I liked that because it's an image of how the surrounding tissue helps support the cancer, and I think from a public health perspective that we can extend that out to the community and to the ecosystem, that these tumors are initiated and they grow supported not only by the local tissue environment but by the broader environment that we are living in. So that's sort of a quick trip through the development of a breast tumor from this ecological perspective.
Yeah, great. I think that's wonderful. What do we know about the incidence of breast cancer? What's been happening who gets it, what age they get it, and where they may live and so forth? What do we know about the epidemiology, that is?
Well, there are about 240,000 new cases of invasive breast cancer annually in women in the United States. Men get breast cancer, too, but they're far less likely to. The incidence rates in recent years among white women in the United States has been fairly stable, at about 135 per 100,000 women per year. In African American women, the rates were lower than that for a long time until, unfortunately, last year, when African American women were reported to have a pretty similar incidence rate of breast cancer as white women. And for reasons that we don't fully understand, African-American women tend to have more aggressive and hard-to-treat breast cancers than white women did. I was interested in looking at breast cancer incidence in Alaska and found that it's very common for Alaskan natives and American Indians to be lumped together in an analysis of breast cancer incidence, and it's reported to be considerably lower than white women in the United States. But when you tease this apart, it actually appears that Alaskan Native women have an incidence rate of breast cancer that's very similar to white women. In other words, it's high at 135 per 100,000 per year. The reason why the number appeared lower when you lump it together with American Indians is because American Indians in the southwest of the United States have a sharply lower incidence rate of breast cancer. So that just brings that average down. So I think it's important to look at subgroups of people to see what the rates really are. About 12% of breast cancer happens before age 45, so most of it is postmenopausal. About 40,000 women in the United States die of breast cancer annually. Fortunately, death rates have been going down as treatments have improved. And about 5 to 10% of breast cancer is thought to be due to hereditary gene mutations, but that leaves, of course, the vast majority of it to be explained by other things.
Like environment.
Yeah, the environment. I mean, that's what's left.
Okay.
Yeah.
What are the kind of accepted common environmental risk factors that perhaps many women are familiar with?
Yeah, sure. Age, of course, is one. As women get older, the risk goes up. Family history is a strong accepted risk factor. The gene variations that people are typically familiar with, the BRCA mutations, BRCA1 and 2, are the kinds of hereditary gene mutations that increase risk. A personal history of breast cancer, dense breast tissue is a risk factor for breast cancer, and we don't fully understand why some women have more dense breast tissue than others. Benign breast disease, which often shows up in adolescence and early adulthood, is a risk factor for breast cancer. Late age of pregnancy, of the first pregnancy, is a risk factor for reasons I explained earlier, because of the prolonged period of having more cells at risk. Not having children at all is a risk factor. Early age of puberty is a risk factor, and that may be for a couple of different reasons. Not only is a woman exposed to more estrogen for a longer period of time because she begins having her periods earlier, but in addition, there's some evidence that the hormone levels are actually higher in women who start having their periods earlier. If a woman has a delayed or late age of menopause, that increases the risk. And then there are things like chest radiation, particularly early in life, which is a risk factor. Recent oral contraceptive use seems to be a risk factor as well, although that disappears when oral contraceptive use is stopped. And we know that women who were taking combination hormone replacement therapy, a combination of estrogen and progesterone post-menopause, are at increased risk of breast cancer. And then cigarette smoking and alcohol consumption are clearly on that list as well. So those are some of the common risk factors that are fairly well accepted.
Dr. Suttler, we are almost halfway through. It's amazing how fast these programs go sometimes.
Yeah.
And I think this may be a good time for us to take our typical one-minute break. We have a couple of emails, and then I really want to get into these environmental exposures, which is the purpose of the program. So if you don't mind, we're going to take this break, and we'll be right back. Let me remind listeners once again, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take about a one-minute break, and we'll continue our discussion on environmental influences on breast cancer with Dr. Ted Shetler. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard, and my guest today is Dr. Ted Shetler. He is the science director for Science and the Environmental Health Network. He received his MD degree at Case Western and MPH from Harvard School of Public Health. He is going to be in Alaska this next week, Monday, April 25th, about a week from today. He'll be doing a reception here at the Alaska Public Media TV studio at 6:30, and then a lecture from 7 to 8 p.m. And then Friday, this Friday, April 22nd, he does grand rounds for medical professionals at Providence Hospital. That would be from 8 to 9 a.m. He also will have trips to Fairbanks and Nome. For more information, call 907-222-7714, or you can email Emily, EMILY.K at alaskaaction.org. And I want to also mention that the trip and lectures are all sponsored by the Alaska Community Action on Toxics and the Alaska Run for Women. So I would think maybe one of the poster children for this idea of environmental influences on cancer and breast cancer might be the diethylstilbestrol story that affected women. I'm not sure when that was, maybe the 1970s, but maybe you can fill us in on that.
Yes, 50s and 60s, yeah.
Okay.
Some women were given diethylstilbestrol during pregnancy with the expectation that it would reduce the risk of miscarriage. And by the way, there was no evidence that was true. But anyway, that's the reason it was promoted. And what we've learned since then is there were a lot of consequences to the offspring, to the sons and daughters, particularly the daughters born to those women who took diethylstilbestrol. The first things that showed up were unusual cancers of the reproductive tract, the vagina and cervix and so on, and malformations of the reproductive tract. But more recently, after the years have passed, we've learned that women who were exposed to DES in utero are at increased risk of almost a two-fold increased risk of breast cancer decades later, which makes the point about the importance of the in utero environment and how it can influence cancer risk decades later. Similarly, we've learned that now that higher DDT exposures, the DDT being a pesticide, a persistent pesticide that is no longer used, but because it was used and it's persistent and builds up in our bodies, we still carry, many of us still carry around residues. But studies were done in recent years showing that higher DDT exposures in utero and before adolescence were associated with a 4 to 5-fold increased risk of breast cancer, whereas if the higher exposures occurred later in adulthood, it didn't seem to carry that same increased cancer risk. So again, it makes the point about the importance of earlier life exposures.
How about some of the, let me put it this way. I know I've looked at your book. You have a book that's available on Amazon with the same title as the lecture series, The Ecology of Breast Cancer. The rest of the title is The Promise of Prevention and the Hope of Healing. By the way, that's also, there's a link to that book on our website at Line One, Your Health Connection, and also a link to a PDF of the book. I've happened to look at that book. So there's a number of environmental exposures that you haven't mentioned earlier that are worth discussing. And why don't we do that now?
Yeah, that'd be fine. To step back and look at a variety exposures and really do a deep dive into the epidemiologic literature to see what we know, what we suspect, and what we don't know. So I'll just go through them briefly. I think that diet and nutrition are very important things that have been looked at for a long time. And I guess I would summarize this by saying the early studies began to look at adult diets and how they might influence breast cancer risk. And the results were often inconsistent, although some signals did appear. It looked like higher levels of saturated fat and certainly trans fats modestly increased the risk of breast cancer. And it looked like a diet that was abundant in fruits and vegetables modestly decreased risk. But I think the story that emerges here again is about the importance of diet in early life. And this has been possible because some long-term epidemiologic studies that actually enrolled women in the study when they were much younger than the previous studies. And so they were able to get an idea about childhood and adolescent diets and then follow these women as they aged over a long time. So, for example, the Nurses' Health Study Number 2 has done that kind of thing, and they've published a tremendous amount from that study showing that higher amounts of red meat in the diet during adolescence increase breast cancer risk by about 20%, that you diminish that risk by substituting at least one red meat meal per week with more plant-based proteins. So, you know, the take-home message from the Nurses' Health Study, too, is eat plenty of fiber. Fiber reduces breast cancer risk. Plant-based proteins and fats, fruits and vegetables, nuts, and whole soy products are protective, which some people find surprising, thinking that soy is estrogenic, but it's the whole soy product that appears to be protective. And if you start taking soy supplements or fractionated soy, like in processed food, that protective effect doesn't seem to be there. Their exercise and physical activity is a strong influence on breast cancer risk. It does it through a variety of mechanisms. It can alter hormone levels and metabolism. It helps, of course, in weight control, and overweight or obesity is a strong risk factor for postmenopausal breast cancer, not so much for premenopausal. The important message with exercise and activity, physical activity, is begin early, begin in childhood. Graham Colditz, a cancer epidemiologist from Washington University, says, you know, breast cancer prevention needs to start at age two. I would argue it should begin prior to pregnancy, but that aside, he points out how important it is for childhood diets and exercise to reflect what we know about these risks and to begin that early and often. Environmental chemicals have been posed as being responsible for breast cancer, and I've mentioned DDT and DES. We now know that there are a number of chemicals that have endocrine-disrupting effects, meaning that they can interfere with hormone activity, hormone levels, signaling mechanisms that are important for tissue development. And in many, many animal studies, things like bisphenol A, for example, which is a ubiquitous contaminant that's found in our food supply and other consumer products, actually can alter the trajectory of breast development, creating tissue architecture that's more susceptible to cancer development. We don't have those studies in people. We just don't have epidemiologic studies that have measured something like bisphenol A during infancy or during in utero development, and then followed for decades to see whether that increases cancer risk. And we probably never will have those kinds of studies. But DES and DDT are proof of the concept, and we need to pay a lot of attention to these chemicals that can disrupt endocrine function. And then there are environmental chemicals in the workplace that adult women encounter that increase risk. And I would refer you to a really nice report from the Breast Cancer Fund, which is available freely online, in which they reviewed those data showing which kinds of professions and which kinds of chemicals in the workplace are associated with increased risk. I would also mention vitamin D as being important, and I really want to highlight that for Alaska. There are lots of studies in laboratory studies showing that insufficient levels of vitamin D increase breast cancer risk. The studies in people are somewhat inconsistent, but most of them, not all, but most, show that low levels of vitamin D are associated with an increased breast cancer risk. And I point this out because inadequate vitamin D levels are very, very common in the U.S. population. And it's particularly common in Alaska, where you have really low levels of sunlight during the winter months. And it turns out that people in Alaska who are not eating a traditional diet are really at high risk of inadequate levels of vitamin D, particularly during the winter months. And interestingly enough, adolescents and adults who eat a more traditional Alaska Native diet actually have higher levels of vitamin D, which shows that that diet, as it was traditionally consumed, actually provided important nutrients throughout the year. And then there are things like radiation, where early life exposures are riskier than adult-level exposures, which means that in the medical profession, and as parents, I think we ought to be asking questions about how necessary certain x-rays really are. Finally, I would just briefly mention stress There are some studies showing that severe childhood stress, such as the loss of a parent, can actually be associated with increased breast cancer risk much later. And certainly in women with breast cancer who are undergoing treatment, stress reduction is an important component of a multidimensional approach to breast cancer treatment, which includes not only the conventional therapies, but also improvements in diet, sleep, exercise, stress reduction, and so on. So those are some of the additional environmental factors that I think we have enough information to pay attention to and can think about how to address them in ways that don't cause their own problems while presumably and hopefully reducing breast cancer risk.
We have an email. I'd like to do is spend a little bit extra time on some of these risks that you've just mentioned. And one email, I think, leads us a little bit into this, and maybe it'll let you elaborate a little bit. But the question says, would you ask Dr. Shetler to elaborate on the studies done by the Silent Spring Institute concerning, this email says, more than 200 mammary carcinogens? Is that... What do you are you familiar with the Silent Spring?
Comments? Silent Spring is a wonderful organization in Newton, Massachusetts, that is looking very hard at the environmental chemicals that may be associated with breast cancer. And what the email is referring to is a paper that they published a few years ago, pointing out that there are over 200 chemicals that are in current that are available for use that are in commerce somewhere. That have been studied and shown to cause mammary gland tumors in laboratory tests, in laboratory rodents typically, over 200 of those chemicals. Only a small few of those have been looked at to any degree at all in human epidemiologic studies, and they weren't particularly well done. So what Silent Spring and many others are saying is, look, it's about time to get going on this. We've got this backlog of chemicals that we know that can cause mammary gland tumors in laboratory rodents. The National Institute for Environmental Health Sciences tells us that rodent studies are absolutely applicable to human risks, and we should be using them to inform our thinking. And we need to figure out more rapid ways of assessing these chemicals and ones that haven't yet been tested to see what influence they might have on cancer pathways. So Silent Spring has been a real leader in this regard, has brought this long list of chemicals to our attention, and they are working now to work out more rapid ways of assessing other chemicals to see how they might influence cancer risk.
All right. Thanks very much. There's another email that I want to just address, and I'm going to have to say I'm going to take this one because it really doesn't relate directly to what we're talking about today, but I like to at least give some answer to the questions, and it relates really more to management of breast cancer, which is not the focus of this show, but the emailer asked about a 60-year-old female who has been diagnosed with a small invasive lobular carcinoma, but is not interested in treatment of any sort. She asks, what about the progression of the disease? Are there studies on what happens when there's no treatment, and how should they best proceed? My answer would be is this would not necessarily be an unusual question for a breast cancer specialist. Your decision to treat would be yours alone. However, I would quickly point out from my point of view that I think it'd be important if you have not already to sit down with a cancer specialist, particularly a breast cancer specialist, and really get a good picture of what the natural history of untreated disease, this particular one, the more information you have, the more they know about your past medical history and so forth, the better they can answer those questions for you. Often we are trying to make decisions with incomplete or erroneous information. So let me just throw that out there as a recommendation, unless Dr. Shetler, you want to add anything to that email answer?
No, I think that I would not add anything. Yeah.
What about diet? I want to get back to that because I think it'll allow you, and if I understand it right, people might say, how in the world can diet, what's the mechanism by which diet may, especially early in life, contribute to an increased risk of anything, but particularly breast cancer? What's that mechanism?
Yeah, it's a great question, and people have tried to investigate this in a variety of ways. There are a number of mechanisms. I mentioned, for example, fiber as being important in the diet, that it reduces breast cancer risk. And it's pretty clear from the epidemiologic studies that higher fiber in adolescence is associated with a decreased premenopausal breast cancer risk. Well, proposed mechanisms include that it increases insulin sensitivity, so you have lower levels of insulin and insulin-like growth factors. So people may have heard, for example, of IGF-1, which can drive cancer development, and diet can have an influence on levels of IGF-1. Another mechanism that's been proposed for fiber is that the fiber in the gut, which is not well absorbed, that passes out in the feces, actually absorbs estrogen that makes its way into the gut as it's released into the gut through the bile. So rather than that estrogen being reabsorbed, it's actually eliminated. And so the idea is that what you end up with is lower systemic levels of estrogen. Other mechanisms that the diet may influence, for example, I mentioned the apparent protective effect of whole soy products. Animal studies have shown that whole soy actually activates tumor suppressor genes, which help then suppress any tumor development. Whereas if you tear that soy apart into the isoflavones and soy supplements, you actually find that they can activate oncogenes or cancer genes. So here's an example of why looking at whole foods as opposed to supplements and fractionated foods makes some sense. If we look at meat, depending on how it's cooked, it may develop the char on the outside, which contains polyaromatic hydrocarbons, which are carcinogenic themselves. Finally, I would mention that fruits and vegetables have a rich array of chemicals, phytochemicals in the fruits and vegetables that have a lot of beneficial effects, including reducing inflammation, altering gene expression, and so on. So they help, in my view, one way to think about it, just going back to the soil comment of Charles Huggins, is if you damp down inflammation, and inflammation clearly is a promoter of cancers, you just create a less hospitable environment for cancers to develop. So I think there are a number of different mechanisms in which diet can play a role, and we're learning about more of them all the time.
Okay, great. Thanks very much. We have a phone call. Marge, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
What kind of effect? I'm 58. My brother is 62. And there was a baby that was lost between us. Our mother was given the DES drugs when she was pregnant with us. And I know for myself, I have a history of a miscarriage before I got pregnant with my oldest daughter, and then 12 between her and her little sister, who was is 7 years and 46 days younger than her.
So you're saying you had many miscarriages?
Yes.
Yeah, it's certainly possible that the DES increased the risk of that and is related to that. It's certainly possible. It's a story that many women have experienced, is difficulty getting pregnant and difficulty carrying pregnancies to term after being exposed to DES in utero. I mean, it's not the only cause, of course, of miscarriage, but there's no question it increased risk.
Yeah, okay. I had to have a radical hysterectomy at 42.
Yeah, reproductive problems were experienced, trouble getting pregnant, trouble carrying pregnancies to term was a common outcome of women who were unfortunately exposed to DES in utero.
Okay.
Marge, thanks for your call. And if you haven't made your providers aware, it would be, I think, make sense to anybody, any physicians you're still seeing on a regular basis, make sure they know that you were exposed potentially to DES during your mother's pregnancy.
Yep. They already know.
All right. Well, good luck. Have a good day.
You too. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Which brings up one question that may be too obtuse, but what about the multi-generational effects of something like DES or other things? Are we also at the point where we can say it's not only affects what we're learning about how the genes and environment will interact, that they might affect one set of offspring, but those offspring's offspring as well?
Yeah, it's a wonderful question and an important question. There are some epidemiologic data suggest that grandchildren of women who were treated with DES during pregnancy, that their grandchildren are also increased risk of breast cancer. I don't think that's a consensus at this point, but there are some preliminary data suggesting that. So that exposure two generations ago continues to have an impact. In animal studies, it's very clear that high level exposures to certain chemicals in utero. And then having the exposure stop at the time of birth, and then no further exposure at all, and then allowing the offspring to go on and have their own families, that you can actually see multi-generational effects of these environmental exposures. And that is something that's been published by several different research groups in various laboratories. The extent to which that actually pertains to people is simply not yet known. But this is the idea of epigenetic changes that are transgenerational, that actually change the gene function in the sperm or the egg, and then it's transferred from generation to generation. So this is an area of intense interest, and we still don't know the extent to which that really happens in people, but we have laboratory animal evidence that it does.
The epigenetic changes that that Dr. Shetler's mentioned is that it's very clear that our and we should have known this, we should have expected this before, our genes have got to respond very, very rapidly to changes in the environment. If you really stop and think about it, if I go out running or start lifting weights, you can tell pretty quickly that you improve, and that improvement has to have its origins, the changes that are going back into our genes, telling different, our genetic makeup, telling those genes, different genes to turn on or to start doing more things. So it's very clear that tremendous number of exposures in the environment are affecting our genes as they sit there, which is called epigenetic changes, non-inheritable, so to speak, changes, although there's some evidence, as Dr. Shetler mentioned, these things can be inherited as well. An email. This is from a postmenopausal woman. Says her doctor has encouraged her to take a new form of estrogen supplement to particularly assist in preventing bone loss. Is there any increased risk in breast cancer with this type of hormone therapy? She doesn't mention the name of it in particular.
Well, I always hesitate to get into commenting on this because this is individual medical advice, and yep. and your caller and your or your emailer and your and her physician, of course, have far more information than I do. I would say that she mentioned just estrogen, not combination, but just estrogen.
Right.
And if she has had a hysterectomy, then she is not at increased risk of uterine cancer from taking the estrogen. And I don't think there's any evidence that estrogen alone increased breast cancer risk in postmenopausal women. It was the combination therapy that did. So that's the only comment I would make, is that she's not being advised to take the combination. She's being advised to use estrogen. And I know that clinicians vary to the extent that they worry and pass along the worry of adverse consequences of postmenopausal hormone therapy. The bone loss in her case may be quite severe, and maybe that's why she's being advised. But that's the only comment I would make. It's not combination therapy that's being recommended.
I have a couple of other questions, but we also have, we're in our last 5 minutes, and I want to make sure you have reasonable time to answer the general question is, what are some evidence-based ways that listeners can take that might prevent exposure or avoid unnecessary risk that might increase the risk for breast cancer? And along the same line, what about policy shifts that we might be considering?
Yeah, it's a wonderful question. I think that I named the well-accepted risk factors, and there are things there like cigarette smoking and excessive alcohol that are clearly something that individuals can pay attention to. I've described the evidence surrounding diet and exercise and vitamin D and environmental chemicals, and you'll see if you think about this that the evidence, the strength of the evidence varies, whereas we have a lot of good epidemiologic data on diet and exercise. We don't have nearly the same strength of evidence on environmental chemicals, but we have reason to be worried about them. That said, there are ways to reduce the exposure to environmental chemicals that are plausibly linked. And for example, if you look at the American College on Obstetrics and Gynecology, they already have a policy recommending to that women who are pregnant avoid bisphenol A coming from the lining of food cans and other sources. So that's already a policy of ACOG. If you look at the American Academy of Pediatrics, they already are recommending that all infants, whether formula-fed or bottle-fed, get supplemented with vitamin D. And that's not being followed in many, many cases. And if you look at the Institute of Medicine report on vitamin D, they clearly make the point that there's a wide margin of safety, that adults can be taking up to 4,000 international units of vitamin D3, and it's a safe dose. This is from the Institute of Medicine, that adolescents up to 3,000 and infants and children up to 1,500 international units of vitamin D3. So, again, without having solid evidence that it prevents breast cancer, there's enough there, in my view, to say that low levels are associated with increased risk, that it's safe to think about vitamin D supplementation in the way I've described. I'm not talking about mega doses. I'm talking about doses such as the Institute of Medicine talked about. And then getting to your point on policy, I totally agree. There's something here for everyone. If we think about our schools and our communities, we should be encouraging physical activity and healthy food access and making certain that it's happening, and that we're making the stuff available so that people aren't stuck with lack of physical activity in schools and access to healthy food. If we look at larger government involvement, we might think about how food subsidies are actually driving people toward unhealthy food. We don't subsidize fruits and vegetables nearly as much as we subsidize the kinds of things that end up in processed food that aren't particularly healthy. So we should rethink subsidies, we should rethink government guidelines and regulations and labeling. We clearly need improvement in chemical policy reform in this country because we have these tens of thousands of chemicals in the marketplace, in commerce, that have not been evaluated for their safety. And as we earlier mentioned, several hundred are already linked to mammary gland cancer in animal studies. So we have a backlog here that we really need to clean up. And, of course, there's plenty of opportunity for healthcare providers to get involved as well, looking at these risks and benefits and counseling appropriately. So I think there's something here for everyone to do. It really is an ecological systems problem, and it needs a system-based approach to address it. And I think the blueprint of that is sort of laid out, and we just need to flesh it out and put it to work.
Thanks very much. It has been a pleasure. It's been too fast, and there's just too much information we still need to get to. But I really wanted to express my appreciation for your taking the time again, and good luck with your trip up here. We'll announce the dates again in just a second that you'll be visiting.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I've enjoyed it, and thanks for the invitation.
All right. Have a good evening.
Thank you.
All right. My guest again, Dr. Ted Shettler. He's a science director of science for the organization Science. Science and the Environment Health Network. My apologies for stumbling on that. He will be up here this next week, next Friday. He will be discussing his book, The Ecology of Cancer, in a lecture at Grand Rounds, and then Monday here at the Alaska Public Studio for a public lecture. Dial or call 777-222-7714 for more information. Next week, the topic will be preventing suicide. Don't hesitate to take a chance or to take the opportunity to listen to that particular program. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer. Eric Bork is our audio engineer and web editor. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.